all of us together. We talked about parents and children and about the parenting of children with a room full of people who were parents and children. That was pretty brave of us, I think. And I congratulate you all on your bravery if you were here yesterday. Now, having gotten that brave, we're going to get even more brave today. And we're going to talk about the big one. We're going to talk about sex. So you feel comfortable when we start out? We'll start back at Genesis. That's where it started. Genesis chapter 1, verse 27b. I quote, "Male and female created he them." My deduction from that text is elementary. Sex is God's idea. Not mine, not yours, not our parents. If it was theirs, we wouldn't have a chance, would we? Sex is God's idea. Sex is a three-letter word. God is a three-letter word. And I'm not going to try to get any more mileage out of that, but there are a lot more connections between sex and God than maybe you thought right off. Consider nature. Old Mother Nature is a very sexy old mother, isn't she? However she may appear on the chiffon commercials, she's sexy. Think for a minute about flowers. You have a chance to look at some around here. Everybody know what a hibiscus is? Anybody seen one? Hibiscus is a tropical flower. We grow them in the tropics in St. Louis. Hibiscus is a great big thing. And it is very lush, lavish, extravagant, almost an irresponsible flower. It is so lush and lavish. Almost prodigal use of color and texture. If an efficiency expert were to decide what the job is that this hibiscus has to do, I'm sure he could also decide a much cheaper way to do it. The hibiscus is, you know, just kind of goes everywhere and winds all around and has all this gorgeous color. Now I ask the question, what's all that flower for? What is all that fanciness and extravagance for? It's got one purpose, doesn't it? Pollination. Yes. Reproduction. Or you don't have to have a great big flower to see the lavishness there and to see what a sexy mother Mother Nature is. Examine the smallest one you can find. There are some really teeny ones around here about the size of the head of a pin. And if your eyes work well enough, you can get down there and you can see the whole thing that's there for the hibiscus is there in miniature for these really small flowers. Talk about miniaturization. Somebody's got a hand on that one. There is texture, there is color, there is delicate shading. There are beautiful curves, just like with the hibiscus. And there's a complete reproductive system. And it all has the same end, pollination. Keep the machinery going. Mother Nature is a sexy mother. Yesterday when I was writing this, I looked across the road and there was a bed of white iris over there. And what a display. A little further on, there was it looked like, with my failing eyesight, it looked like a lilac bush with white lilacs on. And so you add to what the iris has, you add that perfume that comes out, the sweet perfume. Mother Nature is a sexy mother. One step further with this old mother. Have you ever watched a bee work? I was trying yesterday to take a photograph of a bumblebee. It's really not easy. They don't fool around much. They really keep moving, don't they? I think I got one, but I was shooting pretty fast. They think they're making honey. That's their idea of what they're up to. What they're also doing is pollinating. Mother Nature is a very sexy mother. Having dealt with Mother Nature now, and the bees and the flowers, I think we're ready to bring it a little closer to home. Sex is God's design. Everything that I've just been saying about Mother Nature, I could easily say about God, except I might offend you, and that's why I didn't. But I could say all of that about God, couldn't I? God's design, God's creation, is just shot through with sex. Sexuality has an awful lot to do with creation. We tend to mess it up, we being people. We mess up sexuality. I think some cultures have handled it better than we. Some cultures have handled it worse than we do. But in general, we tend to mess it up one way or another. If you think of human sexuality, wow, we got this way over here, with a little bit of luck. Good. Thank you. Thank you. You can think of human sexuality as a big thing like this. HS stands for human sexuality, not a lot of other things you can think of. On one side of it, we mess it up with exploitation, with being sexy instead of being sexual, if you can make that kind of distinction, with declaring ourselves to be the inventors of sex, with something that's called pornography. Pornography is not very good sexuality. It's all bent out of shape, and you know that after you get over being excited by it. It's really bent out of shape, sexuality. It's one way to mess up human sexuality. Over on this side, the whole story is whoop it up. Make of it something that it is not. Make it bigger than it is. It's big enough. You don't have to make it bigger. Over on the other side, there's another way in which human sexuality gets messed up. This is not more familiar ground for all of us, I think. Over here lands denial, repression, what I like to call the fig leaf mentality, you know, which keeps it covered all the time. No matter where you are, we keep our sexuality covered and hidden, and we deny that it's there. These are the destroyers of sex on this side. And instead of whoop it up, it's shut it down. One side or the other side. And that's where we operate much of the time, don't we? When do we operate here? Hardly ever, it would seem. It seems to me there might be a strong Christian response to this mess that our culture puts us in. I think the Christian answer is to say, I am sexual because God wants me to be sexual. Nah, it's not my idea. It's not something I discovered in a dark corner and learned how to fool around with and have fun with. I'm sexual because God made me sexual. He wants me to be sexual. Of course, he wants me to be responsible and non-exploitative with this gift, and that isn't easy. But one thing's clear. God does not want me to be non-sexual. Surprised? When you put it in bold words and plop it out like that, it sounds kind of different. God wants me to be sexual. I am sexual because God made me that way. It's not something I'm even equipped to debate, am I? I don't decide I'm going to be sexual on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and not on Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, and we'll flip a coin on Sunday. That's not how I do it. I don't decide about whether or not I'm sexual. I am sexual. It's part of what I am. I am that because God has made me that. Blow any hats off yet? No. Okay. Because of this mess, you know, this is where we're coming from, really, isn't it? This kind of difficulty is what we all live with. Because of this, something happens when people, Christian people, try to talk about human sexuality. Let me erase this mess and put up another one. What happens, I call the pumpkin and the peanut problem, and it looks like this. Imagine you have here a great big gorgeous pumpkin. That's the pumpkin of human sexuality that Christians ought to talk about and pay attention to, okay? But when you try to talk about human sexuality to Christians, what they tend to do is focus on the peanut up here instead. And the peanut is an interesting peanut. You know, if you get close enough and really look at it, it's really an interesting little fellow there. The peanut would be to divert our conversation from the pumpkin of human sexuality down to one small little area. The peanut might be, abortion. It's a very interesting peanut, and it's one Christians ought to pay attention to. There's a lot to be said in that area, a lot to think about, a lot of central issues for human living, central issues for human ethics, for Christian behavior, for psychology, sociology, and a lot of other ologies you could think of. But that's the peanut and not the pumpkin. Or we might get stuck talking about homosexuality right now, because that's a big issue. Again, it's loaded with important stuff. But when we're talking about that, we're not talking about the pumpkin, we're talking about the peanut. I think the reason we steer away from the pumpkin and try to get to the peanut is because we think we're on somehow safer ground. You know? So, what I'm going to try to do today, now, all those topics, all those peanut topics are important and essential, and it's good stuff. It's not, you're not wasting your time, but what I'd like to try to do today is stick to the pumpkin, okay? So much for groundwork. Now, on to the pumpkin, on to what it's all about. Don't panic. I'm not going to talk about positions or techniques or plumbing. I'm going to talk about purpose. The purpose of human sexuality. So everybody can relax. This has a lot to do with the pumpkin. positions, techniques, and plumbing has a lot to do with the pumpkin too. But I assume you've got some information on that, or if you don't, you know where to get it. Fair assumption? I think there are three purposes to human sexuality. I never know which one to put first. I know which one to put last, because that's my punchline, but I don't know which one to put first. I'll put one of them first. Sex is for procreation. That's no surprise. Sex is for making babies. Huh? You knew that. It's the only way we got for doing that. That's pretty important stuff to be involved in, isn't it, making babies? If you don't believe it, talk to some of the parents. making babies carries a lot of responsibility we weren't counting on. Isn't that right, parents? And it lasts and lasts and lasts. That's one use for sex. It is indeed a glorious use for sex. Just a little personal sidelight. This is my wife, Jeanette, here. You might wonder, what was the most important day in Jeanette's life? the most important day ever in her entire life. She's got a long time to live yet, but she's already had her most important day. And I would think, well, maybe it's the day I asked her to marry me. Maybe it's the day she met me when I winked at her in lunch line. Maybe it's the day we stood before the altar and took our vows to each other. Maybe it was a little later on that evening. The truth is, it was none of those days. The most important day in her life was associated with another man. He's sitting right back there, my son Michael. The day he was born was the most important day in her life. Right?
That's true.
I'm not making it up. She goes around telling everybody that. Think what it does to me. But the procreation function of sexuality is a very important one. I remember very clearly, as I think most fathers do, the first time they saw their first child. I know what he looked like. It just turned me inside out. It'll do that for you. I was looking at him, you know, behind the glass, and he was all born, all that was over. That's what we did it in the old days. There I was, you know, looking through the glass, and the nurse was unwrapping him to show me that he had, you know, five on each foot and five on each hand and one head and everything kind of hanging there in the right place. That's a thrilling day. That's an important day. The procreation part of sexuality should not be underestimated. And, friends, it doesn't stop when you see that critter. It goes on till he looks like that and even longer. Procreation is important. Sex has another function. The second one is also one you know about. There's procreation, and then there's recreation. Yes. Sex is fun. Sex is for making babies. Sex is for making whoopee. It's for pleasure. It's strong stuff. Remember the pretty flowers and the busy bees. Sex can be very exciting. Look what it's doing to the fire. You think of what an exciting and interesting thing it is, the thing that's going on among, I guess, some of you young people. I haven't seen it, I'm just assuming. There is a pursuit, a chase, a game is being played between you. It's a very fun game. When you get around to a little farther on and begin to actually have genital sexual interaction with people, that is an absolutely, totally absorbing experience, like almost nothing else you ever do. Isn't that right, those of you who've done that? It completely carries you away. Other things that are fun don't do that, right? Baseball doesn't do that. Ice cream doesn't do that. Whiskey can if you got enough. But that carries you away in a slightly different way. To be really fully aroused, or let me use the better word, fully turned on sexually, is to have a kind of centrality to your life for a while that we hardly ever get. So sex is fun. It's relaxing. It's enjoyable. And it's absorbing. You all knew that. Now I come to the one that I think maybe you didn't know. And if anybody can help me make this one rhyme with the first two, I'll pay you a quarter, because I've done my best and can't. This is the real biggie. Sex is for bonding two people together. There's a phrase we use to describe sexual interaction between two people. We call it, you know, we don't have good words for that we can use in public, right? I just used a whole complicated sentence. Sexual interaction between two people. Wow. That's clumsy. There are words, but they all have four letters. Or worse. But there is a phrase we use in polite company. We call it making love. making love really means, when you get down to it, it means sexual interaction between two people.
But that's exactly what it is. Making love makes love.
It makes love happen between two people. So making love is for making love. We already said that sex is fun, it's pleasurable and totally absorbing. Now I want to show you how it works for making love, how it works for bonding two people together with love, because that's what I'm talking about. I have to ask your indulgence. You've probably seen enough graphs from me already, but I got one more graph I got to draw. I can show you, I think, if you stick with me for the next couple minutes, how sex works as a bonding agent between two people. And now after I get into this a little bit, you're going to realize I really am a psychologist and I haven't given up on that. Say goodbye. This axis is time. And this axis is a whole bunch of things. If you please, a whole bunch of physiological measures, all right? It's blood pressure. It's heart rate. It's muscle tension. Things you can measure. You know, we could hook up some machines to you and measure all this stuff. It's respiration rate. It can be any of those. The curve looks basically the same. And what I'm going to show you with the curve is sexual arousal. Okay? There's a low for each of these and a high for each of these. And what I'm doing now is a gross generalization of all of them. You could find variation, but I'm going to ignore the variation because in general the line goes the same way. But with sexual arousal, you know, without sexual arousal, we bump along kind of like this. Unless we're running cross country or playing basketball or watching John Wayne movies or something really exciting. The physiological measures all stay about the same, unless we are exerting physically or getting excited emotionally. Now, this is what sexual arousal looks like. It starts down here where we live, and it goes up to a high, and then comes down suddenly, sometimes dipping below, and then leveling out. You probably never saw a picture of an orgasm before. There's a picture of it. It occurs right here, the sexual climax. All right? I think everybody in the room knows what I'm talking about. Now, let me be psychologist for a while. You have part of the curve that's going up. That is almost a curve of the pleasure that's happening too, isn't it? You are more and more totally absorbed and totally focused on your sexual activity as you move up this. If I were to interrupt you somehow here by having a PA system wired into wherever you are, and say, okay, gang, now it's time to come for the ping pong tournament. Chances are, if you were here, you wouldn't even hear me. If you did hear me, I might get some angry grumbling. I might get hit in the head. So, the line goes up. This is increasing pleasure. Also, increasing tension of all kinds. That's what this stuff says, right? Tightening up, tightening up, tightening up, tightening up. But it's pleasurable tightening up. A very, very positive experience. Then you get to this point, and there's a very rapid reduction. Really fast. All these measures drop down. Plunk. They drop down faster in sexual activity than they do in other activity. Talk to a cross-country runner. It takes him 5 minutes to walk back down, doesn't it? 10 maybe. Talk to any athlete. Talk to yourself after a hike up the mountainside. It takes a while to come back down, doesn't it? To get the whole system settled down again.
but sexual activity happens rapidly. This, too, is pleasurable, as this is, but it's got something going on in addition. It is pleasure plus the rapid reduction of all kinds of tension, which you might not experience and cognize as pleasurable, but we psychologists know that it's something else. That is, it is highly reinforcing. This is one of the problems, by the way, with alcoholism. What does alcohol do to you? Well, it makes you all kind of loose and easy, doesn't it? That's a very reinforcing experience. You're going to go back for more. Yeah. The same thing happens right here. So, we've kind of pulled apart the whole sexual arousal and discharge business. And we've defined it as pleasurable. Now, you remember Pavlov's dog? I'm going to take you back that far. Pavlov, a Russian scientist, had a dog. And he noticed that if he'd hold a plate of meat in front of the dog would salivate. Make saliva. And so he'd present him with the plate of meat, and the dog would always make saliva. And then Pavlov got a bright idea one day, and he thought, I know what I'll do. I'll show him the meat, and I'll ring a bell at the same time. And so he showed him the meat, and he rang the bell. Next day, again, show him the meat, and ring the bell. Show him the meat, and ring the bell. Show him the meat, ring the bell. He did that about 500 times. Ring the bell, show the meat. Then finally came the big day. Each time he'd do this, the dog would salivate. Then came the big day. He came in with no meat, just the bell. Ding-ling-ling. And the dog drooled all over the place. Next day he came in again. No meat, just the bell. Ding-ling-ling. Dog drooled all over the place again. And out of that came the whole notion of conditioning. You can take one thing, pair it with another. You pair it often enough. You only need the one now, not the original one, but the second one, and you get the same response. So what gets paired together sticks together, huh? What gets paired together with all this pleasure?
Your partner?
Treating your partner how? Tenderly, affectionately, gently, caringly, in a way in which you treat your partner with concern? That's pretty nice stuff. All of that gets paired together with this tremendous pleasure. What that does is bonds two people together. That is, if you're having the same partner. You can mess around with this, can't you? It is still very pleasurable, but it doesn't work for bonding. If each time you have that experience, you have it with a different partner, you won't be bonding to a person. You won't be. You can keep it from happening. Just imagine now, if both partners in the experience are having this happened to them. Doesn't have to be simultaneous, that's a lot of bull, but it can happen to both people, okay? Each time it happens to both people, they are bonded that much more closely. Isn't that a great thing? Sex is for procreation, recreation, and I still can't make it rhyme, bonding. Sorry?
Unification?
That's close.
Unification.
That's getting there.
Lamination.
There we are. You get the quarter.
That's beautiful.
You have to come from Oregon.
Oh.
That's perfect.
We got a poet somewhere. Who said that?
You said it. Thank you. I'll do better than that.
Snack bar after
that. I'll have you over for a beer. That's even better. Now, knowing that about human sexuality, you can see how a lot of things kind of fall into place, don't they? The idea of marriage as a lifelong contract, right? And as an exclusive contract. If you're going to be bringing other people into this, you're going to mess up the bonding. Not destroy it, but dent it. Wreck it. Bonding, by the way, is quite different, I think, from falling in love. I think it happens at a different level. I think it often, for a great many people who are married and who have this kind of experience mutually again and again and again and again, the bonding that occurs, because nobody talks about it, occurs kind of out of their awareness. They don't know why they're so stuck on each other. They don't like each other sometimes. You know, they fight about what color to paint the kitchen and all sorts of dumb stuff like that. But they really are stuck to each other. Here's a big reason why. When we talked about communication, we said there was another way to be bonded to other people. This is the other way. The only other way I know about is by empathic conversation. That bonds people together. Now, if you got a man and a woman who are able to exchange feelings with each other, who are able to assist each other, feel with each other emotionally, and are able to pull this number off every once in a while, I think there ain't no way in the world you're going to get those two apart, unless they really have horrendous difficulties dealing with the changes that occur in life. That's my major idea. I think God designed human sexuality for those three purposes: recreation, procreation, lamination. Bonding really takes a while. It doesn't happen with one or two experiences. And it can be damaged by adding partners or by subtracting pleasure and adding pain or something like that. There. Now, you've let me have my say about human sexuality. Now it's your turn to have your say. Let the questions come from anywhere. I'll wait. I blew your hats off. Your heads too.
Can you tie this in with marriage? Unmarried or married?
I think only in the ways that I've indicated. In a couple ways I can. I think in my generation, premarital sex usually happened under less than optimal conditions. You know, the back seat of the car, the blanket on the beach with all that sand, places like that. The you know, living room sofa waiting for father to come down for his glass of water. And so conditions weren't right for a very good experience like this. The experience would be messed up somehow or another. I think it's very possible today with unmarried people living together for a lot of bonding to happen. I think it's a little dangerous to have a lot of bonding happen to a person with whom you have no strong covenant of permanence. Something that begins to happen, you know, maybe something I didn't say about the bonding experience is this lady and I could be fantastic great friends.
We could empathize all over the place. Hmm? We could really be very, very, very super good friends. She could be the best friend in my whole life. And if we didn't have this experience going, there would be some feelings I would not have for her. I would want the relationship to continue. I would admire her as a person. I would think she was really great. You know, if I was a priest and she were a nun, we could be great, great friends. We could have the greatest thing in the world going. But we would not have going for us what we could have if we were husband and wife. Because when this experience starts to happen, a piece of the bonding that I'm sure many of you have already experienced cognitively and noticed is when you begin having sexual relationship with a person, what do you want? You want it to continue, don't you? You begin to have an urge towards permanence in that relationship. I want to be with you all the time. I want this to go on. You also have an urge towards exclusivity. I want to do this with you and nobody else, and I don't want you to do this with anybody else. Right? So, for people who are not married, who don't have a really clear, permanent contract with each other, to engage regularly in sexual activity, I think, runs the risk of some real hurt. Now, if it's seen as experimental, or if it's seen as movement toward permanence and exclusivity, is that a word? Then I think you're moving in the right direction. I think it's quite possible for people to be very bonded without being married. You know, the marriage is a social contract, as well as all kinds of other things. Did I answer your question, or is it just muddy the water?
Yeah.
Okay.
In premarital sex, for all practical purposes, couldn't you erase everything on the chart except the straight vertical line through the mountain?
How do you mean?
What I mean is that it goes up to this point, and this part here is absent.
Oh.
End up down there.
I don't think so. I think you're misunderstanding the time span that I'm talking about. I'm talking about a very short time span. The total chart, you know, is average about 7 to 15 minutes of sexual arousal, and down. This part of it is a matter of a few minutes.
Yeah, but also, it would depend on your attitude towards it. If you hit that point there, is there some feelings as to what you have done, what you have been driven to, and afterwards, wouldn't there be a feeling that perhaps you maybe have done something wrong?
Okay, maybe
and
so.
And then you go kapow right to the bottom?
Some married people have that problem too, you know, because they were brought up, remember that first drawing, with a lot of restriction.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. A different attitude over that.
I see what you're saying. Yeah. Once the release occurs, there's a bucket load of bad feelings that flood in on you. Huh? Mm-hmm. Oh, what kind of a beast am I? I'm a terrible person. I've done something awful. I'm sinful. I'm ashamed of myself. On and on and on. Yeah.
Or will you hate me in the morning?
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Right. That's another thing that can damage the bonding. I think there are married people who don't have much of this kind of bonding because they don't have a very fulfilling sexual life with each other. I think that's unfortunate. Sometimes that can be remedied. It's not always easy to remedy, and you're running against often a lot of very deep-seated feelings in that sort of situation. I feel sorry for people like that. I think they're missing an important part of what God has in mind when He creates us.
I've asked another question, and probably have something to do with this, but probably don't. And it has to do with rape. What? I don't quite understand the feelings of what a rapist would be in regards to sex.
Very different from most people.
Extremely different.
Yes. People who deal with rapists talk about the motivation being very minimally sexual, and in the main it is hostile and aggressive. It's attacking behavior. It is really not sexual behavior. It just happens to use sexual equipment. It's attack.
Domination principle, isn't it?
Yeah. Where the way most males are wired, if they are angry enough, they can't respond sexually.
I just couldn't understand how something like that could
take Yeah, that's place why.
Without mutual agreement.
How
sexual act can take place without mutual agreement on both sides.
Uh-huh. I think a rapist is really pretty badly bent out of shape person in general, because the way most males are, they are not even sexually potent when they're very angry. It's impossible to be. You know, we can't be terribly angry and sexually aroused at the same time. We're just not wired that way. That's short circuit. Doesn't work. We have to be relaxed and comfortable and feeling pretty good before we can even get turned on. The rapist's got some wires crossed, and he can attack in a sexual way. Michael?
What you were saying before about risking getting hurt with that bonding going on without the contract.
Yeah.
Do you think that's a lasting hurt, or is it something you can get over?
Oh, it's something you can get over. But both people take that risk, and you take that risk with each other. That's, it may be a risk you're deciding to take. It could be. I don't think any permanent damage is necessarily done. Some permanent damage could be done. Not too likely with the kinds of attitudes I see about that sort of thing.
Well, one of the things that I see in sex is also a symbolic function. When I'm talking premarital with couples, I talk in terms of the sacrament of sex.
Yeah, so do I. Beautiful.
and in that sense, it's saying something. You're saying something very profound, more than what you're just doing bodily. You're saying things which sort of culminate your whole relationship. And I guess in the difficulty I have with making love with someone else is saying something, I mean, if it's outside the context of a permanence and exclusivity, is that it's saying something that you're not saying. It's saying what you're not saying otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I don't see it really in sync, is when you're saying with your body what you in the rest of your life aren't saying with your whole style, namely, you know, we're really making a go of this thing together, a total interpenetration of our lives.
At the same time, I think, on the other side of the argument, if I can be there for a minute and we'll dialogue it, I believe that some terribly important learning needs to go on. What was I saying the other day? I was saying something was like ice skating. Oh, the developing child taking over his or her own life and running their own life, being responsible for themselves rather than having a parent controlling all the way along. That's like roller skating or ice skating. You're not terribly good at it the first time. So is sex. You know, who expects the first time you play ping pong to hit the ball back every time? You don't. It takes a lot of crawling on the table to learn how to do that right. Similarly with sexual behavior. There are ways in which one can learn about one's sexual response personally. Some of those ways are thought to be very terrible and very forbidden. People have a lot of feeling about that. I don't think that's necessarily a terrible thing to do. I think it's probably an essential thing to do. What you learn is very important. There might be some very casual, full sexual experiences like this that would not result in a continuing relationship, but would result in a lot of learning about oneself and one's sexuality, because those would most likely involve some kind of exploitation of another person. It is probably something that falls under the general rubric of sin. You're both learning about sexual response. You're both risking a little bit with each other and taking chances with the other person, and manipulating very likely, and having extraneous goals other than bonding in mind, having just pleasure, you know, try to, I almost said have your cake and eat it too, but I won't say that. Because of all these other additions, because it would be something you'd want to confess and seek absolution for. Have I muddied the water?
I'd like to speak to a point you made about how you can have, you know, really good conversations with a person, be really intimate in that way, but unless there's a sexual relationship, there's just something that you don't share. You just never get to that fullness of sharing. Relationship, and you were saying that, you know. And I was just wondering, as far as that goes, you know, like at Holden Village, we stress so much the humanity of Jesus Christ, you know, that he came to earth and he was made man, and yet he must have had to deal, being very human, he must have had to deal a lot with his own celibacy and with knowing that he wasn't ever to share in that type of a relationship. As far as I understand it from the Bible, he never was involved in a relationship where that fullness came to be, in a sexual relationship. And I just wondered how you thought he would speak to us today, you know,
about that.
On celibacy and, yeah.
Can I add something on the end of that? If Kathleen doesn't mind me before you answer?
Sure.
Do you mind, Kathleen? No. That along the line of what she's saying there, I think that in your presentation you started out very well talking about all human sexuality, and I don't think you ended up on the peanut, but I think you ended up on half the pumpkin. And it connects with what Kathleen said, because you're talking about the sexual act.
Yeah.
You know, and what happens between two people. And that's all very nice, but there are an awful lot of people in the world who are not nuns and priests, but who are single, and who have a serious consideration of human relationship, are not willing to simply enter into sexual acts for the pure pleasure of it with no bonding, but have no relationship where that is possible. In the long line, she was referring also to your comment about two friends sharing, but it's never really any good.
I know you didn't say that.
I retract that. But that, you know, the bonding would not happen without the sexual act. You know, that, you know, you are, that what you've been saying then becomes very exclusive. And I think to many of us in our room, in this room, too. And then that's tacked on to what Kathleen had to say about our Lord and his wife.
Okay, it's... I guess the point I'm trying to make is that something happens in sex other than sexual release. There is a kind of bonding that takes place. I'll show you my hatchet work. You know, let me take you into my workshop and show you how I get here. Okay, that might help. Where I first began catching on to that, to the sudden flow of feelings between people that occurs when the relationship becomes genital. Okay? is in my work with homosexuals, of all things. Now I'm back on the peanut. Not on the pill, I'm on the peanut. And in working with homosexuals, two men could have a very strong friendship relationship. It was not sexual in a genital way. Okay? There was no sexual play going on between them. They were very good friends. They would share all kinds of things, all kinds of interests, all kinds of good times together, all that. They didn't have to tell me when their relationship became genital, because I could tell like that. Because they were suddenly dependent on each other. Suddenly possessive. I then made the transfer to the heterosexual relationship, and I see the same thing. So something happens in addition. Maybe I was choosing wrong words to describe it.
I'm not disagreeing with that.
No, I know you're not.
But
I'm wanting you to see how I got there.
Okay.
And maybe clarify what it, help me clarify what it is that I'm saying. I think my relationship with Jeanette could be a beautiful, strong, powerful relationship. But because it is also a sexual relationship, it has something added to it. If she were only my friend, I would desire that to continue. But since she is not only my friend, but also my constant sex partner, I more than desire that to continue. You know, I'm gonna put more of myself in preserving that. Okay? If she were only my friend and decided she wanted to teach in Chicago, I'd say, you know, okay, if that's really what's gonna fulfill you, I'll see you on an occasional weekend. But since she's my wife, if she wants to teach in Chicago and that's the only way it can be, then I gotta go to Chicago too. I don't wanna go to Chicago. I think that's all I'm saying. As far as the question up here, it's an interesting kind of box you put me in, or I put myself in, and I really haven't thought about it very much. I guess the only answer I can give sounds like a cop-out, and I'm afraid it probably is. The answer I would want to give would be that he denied himself that, because of the nature of his mission, as celibate people might today. People who choose a celibate life in order to serve in some particular way that they couldn't serve if married. What it means is I have a human experience with this lady here that our Lord did not have, as far as I know.
In a sense, we want to share. I mean, part of loving and love from God is to share. And we do that in the marriage, in the sexual relationship. And always. And it's just a sense of somebody that chooses a celibate way of life. They've chosen to share in that particular way. And that's, they've chosen to go higher. And
they've chosen to what,
John?
Celibacy ain't always a choice.
I agree with that, yes.
Well,
there are people who have consciously decided to be single, celibate, and all that because they can be more effective, this has been particularly true in the Christian church, more effective that way. But within the Christian church and in the world, there are a heck of a lot of people who their, inclination would be to have that kind of a relationship where they could share in the in-depth way that Paul's been talking about here. But by the, just in the course of their life, that has not been the possibility. you know.
Okay, but in the same sense, there's people who are married and have a sexual relationship that don't have a sexual.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of combinations here, you know. But my point is, how about, you know, you can talk about the sexual attitude of blue in the face and what it does and everything else, and it's very helpful for the people that are in that relationship. What about the rest of us, you know? I mean, do we, you know, there's all kinds of talk. On the one hand, the church can say, repress it. You're non-sexual.
No, it can't.
That's one thing that's said.
I won't let that happen.
No, I'm saying that this is one thing that's said, you know, because it's said.
Yes, yes.
And you start, you know, at the beginning of this and talk about, you know, some way there, you know, if we affirm relationships with each other and we affirm the totality of our life, the abundant life given us by God and Jesus Christ, how we're created, you know, how do we help each other affirm our sexuality? You know, how do I affirm, you know, a marital relationship and the sexuality they have? How do you affirm mine? I'm not in one.
Time for a commercial. I think it really is appropriate. I left open purposely tomorrow's session on the flip side of what Paul is talking about. And it sounds to me like it would really be good to continue this in the area of Christian ethics. I'll move from a theological position, but it'll be the very similar concern. And I'd like to tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, talk about sex for a single Christian.
What, you know, really, I'm sorry, I'm going to keep after this for a minute, though. So we talk about sex for the homosexual, we talk about sex for the single person, we talk about sex for the divorced person, sex for the married person. You know, it doesn't hold water with how I understand the Christian community, to separate out all the time. You know, how do we get at affirming all of us with all that we've been created, as we've been created?
Here.
I'm not sure I'm hearing. Try again, please.
Anybody want to add?
I don't think. If we get at that, maybe we don't get at it through sex. You know, maybe that's in a different lecture. And I don't know where exactly you're getting off and what kind of response you're looking for.
Well, I'm just opening some discussion.
Well, but doesn't the Bible state that marriage isn't for everybody, that there are those who don't
marry? Marriage is different than sexuality. That was what I was trying to ask, was how did Christ affirm his sexuality? You know, like, how does he speak to me as a young single person if he's my daily Lord and Savior? You know, where do I find out what he did affirm his sexuality in a single state?
Maybe sexuality doesn't have to be affirmed.
That's what I was going to say.
You start using the same word of affirm for a whole, totally different things. It's like we affirm each other by eating together over in the dining hall, and it's an important thing, but still no one has to, you know, to urge me to go or anything like that. I mean, it's not an affirmation of some abstract kind of a thing that needs to be built up or torn down. What you're talking about is an affirmation in terms of thinking, I think. And like in the Old Testament, God says about eunuchs or others who, you know, who are excluded from this, they can have a family too, you know. Their name will be great if they follow my commandments and such. I mean, that's an affirmation of their potency, even if in a physical sense they have no potency. Yet, in God, they've got potency. Maybe that's a kind of affirmation.
Wouldn't the answer to the question be that you can live without it?
But see, what you're saying is that if there's an intimacy in a relationship, there's a fullness that comes in a sexual relationship, and if you don't have it, where does that fullness come? You compensate by doing something else when you know that the fullness rests in that, in the whole sexuality realm.
Celibate people I know do. Do exactly what you're saying. They compensate in other ways.
Okay. I've worked with high school kids the last 4 years, and it's really exciting because a lot of these questions come to me as a single person. And the big gap, too, is, you know, marriage to a lot of the high school kids that have talked to me and also to me seems like such a big switch step. I mean, because of the attitudes that have come to me from my family, from my church, that marriage is the time for the deep communication, and it's a big gap before that. The question that comes up a lot, though, is the media presents such a, I don't know, a light picture of sex many times. Stars Born, where they roll around the desert. It was just fantastic, but I don't know how they survived all the cactus needles. But this picture is presented, it's very exciting to the kids. It's really there, but it's sometimes very unreal. Sometimes, especially Psychology Today just presented an article that, is there sex after 40, and most people don't believe so. In the movies, nobody ever has wrinkles when they're making love. And I guess the question, too, is that the kids ask me more why not than why. And it's a dealing with a lot of questions of, okay, if the contract and the commitment is very needed for that intimacy, it seems like the answer that I can give most readily from my own experience and my own feelings is that the trust is the best way for a person, for me to tell someone else that my love is unconditional, is to say forever. And that provides a very strong base for that intimacy. And yet I also have friendships that I say, well, George, you're stuck with me forever because I really like you and I intend to be very loyal and I intend to keep on growing. And that's a promise that it's very, good, I feel. But how did you develop these? Most of the kids I talk to have a very big fear motivation when it comes to sex. And I don't want to think about marriage until I'm 26, so I'm going to take this sex and I'm going to try to put it back here, or else I'm going to deal with it very irresponsibly. And that's my own situation, too. I'm going to be single, so how do I deal with those thoughts right now and still, keep growing? And it's just...
And of course, there are no easy answers to those many questions, right?
Right.
And that's that's the half of the pumpkin that I've not addressed, and really don't know how to address. Does that get me off the hook?
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody does, very much, We're into developing new patterns and lifestyles. Maybe they're not going to work. Maybe they are, but we haven't got it together yet. The biblical model is pretty old, huh? And didn't know about a lot of new patterns and lifestyles. Knew about pretty well one, or at most two. It knew about marriage, and it knew about eunuchs, and it knew about celibates. And that's what it knew about. And it knew about a lot of promiscuity and all that stuff. Another honorable, God-fearing option really wasn't there. If you lived at the time of Jesus, you either got married or lived celibately or were promiscuous. And there was no honorable option, right? And that's kind of the basis that we're coming at it from. And I guess I'm old-fashioned enough to think that may be all there is, gang, and that we're kidding ourselves about other options, but let's not shut down the search. I'm not ready to do that.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing about being single and having a very positive view of marriage and yet not thinking that singleness is a disease that marriage is a cure for, what do you do with that?
Yeah.
You see,
my generation, life was a sickness and marriage was the cure. Huh? You were there and so you got married.
Paul, I think that the really hopeful thing, though, is that I went to a Lutheran college 20 years ago, and we had a class that was labeled, health/sex. And if we got off of anything but vegetables and nutrients and so forth to talk about anything resembling anything like this 20 years ago in a Lutheran college, it was unheard of. And the fact that we can now sit down together and explore and talk out loud about these kinds of concerns is just so hopeful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so we haven't got the answers yet. By golly, at least we're asking the questions.
There has been a little bit of
yeah.
progress.
And so I think you guys are all moving in the right direction.
I have a question.
And that's great.
And I'd like to ask, it doesn't deal with this, but the first part of what you said. Do you feel there's a difference in words or explanation between procreation and reproduction?
Can I?
I'm using them interchangeably.
You do?
Yeah.
Okay. Is somebody going to answer that?
Can I tag in something along that too? Yeah, what are your feelings about procreation and overpopulation? I mean, did man mess up, or did God just forget? Or
God wasn't very good at me.
Oh dear. Population explosion is very much a reality. It's I think a large part of what's happening in terms of world hunger is a result of overpopulation, and I think it's partly caused technologically. You know, all the standard answers. How does it all fit into God's design? I don't know. I look at the rest of nature, and did you ever look at a dandelion when it was all puffed out into the ball? You know, one dandelion makes enough seeds to do your lawn, right? One. Just one flower. I see that kind of lavishness in the reproductive scheme all around me. And it's there. Somebody who's good at the statistics, fill me in. One thimble full of male semen is enough to inseminate how many females? God, it's a huge number. It really is. So you know, it's kind of, that's the way it is.
I think maybe Noah's rule was good. Only two.
He says that looking at a man with three. He, a man with two, looks at a man with three and says Noah's rule, and I say...
Isn't there some sense of, I mean, we're living in God's love, so therefore, you know, I mean, I just look at myself, and I had Mark family, and I just said, well, how much love can I give my children, and what's the maximum kind of love I can give them? You know, if I had a dozen and on the wages that I make or something like that, you know, could I really, you know, would I be out working two jobs to support half a dozen kids? You know? Would I really be giving them the kind of love that I should, you know?
Yeah.
It seems to me that some years ago that didn't hold a whole lot of water, because the more kids you had, the bigger farm you could
work.
You know,
yeah.
And it was all a family project. But we don't live in that kind of society anymore. And well, there's so many things competing for your children's, you know, taking them out of the family. And I just got to say to myself, you know, well, if I'm going to share this love that God's given me, you know, what I do, you know, and I can't let them starve, that's surely not about, you know, giving them love, you know, if it's that kind of thing, like in India. You know.
I don't think I'm questioning the number of children, it's just the fact of God's design. It is, yeah, that the whole procreation is like the dandelions. And why is that? Did God design it for a less technological society, or was infanticide, I mean, was that sort of view of death a more natural or a more positive thing, you know, to have more people die all the time, or what, you know?
Was
it getting toward the end times, and that's why, you know,
if my kind of theologizing would say God did this overkill in terms of reproduction. Overkill isn't a good phrase, but you know what I mean. You know, he fixed us up. He fixed the whole universe, the whole world up, so that if all the reproduction happened that could, we'd all be squeezed right off of here.
He did that because he knew how damn clumsy we are, and how likely we are to kill each other, and how likely we are to mess things up.
Then what do you counter the fact that people say, well, the reason, you know, there are wars and things are because of overcrowding, because, you know, it's become too crowded, and that's why that brings out aggression, and that sort of thing?
I think that's cop-out.
or
some kind of lag, you know. One of the reasons we have the population explosion is because of modern medicine, which has reduced infant mortality and extended the lifespan. Modern medicine also gives us conception control methods, which frequently we choose not to use. So, you know, the technology is there, at least rudimentarily. And I'm losing my audience, and I think it's time to quit.
Well, you know, you mentioned a thimble full of semen. So that we, and you think about the dandelion. Well, there's also the fact that women have a natural immunity to the, or casting off of the sperm. So in that same sense, you know, you think those millions, it only takes one. And the chances of that one getting there are really tremendously bad, really.
Okay.
Yeah, because of the pH and all that
right.
stuff. You know.
There's some built-in.
And the dandelions have the same thing, you know. You kill off the deer and the trees go. You know, you kill off the trees and the deer go. Because they eat the new growth.
I want to make a comment. Ever since Kathleen was talking, and Nancy, and everyone's gone now, I've been kind of wanting to say this, but not wanting to interrupt, but doggone it, I'm going to say it. I think, getting back to the idea of love and sex, that sex, I can see it, you know, right there, creates a bond between people, a deep bond that is probably deeper than anything I've experienced till now. However, Kathleen's point was good, that if Jesus is love, total incarnate love, then love by definition does not have to include sex. It has to be possible for me to love other guys without being a homosexual, to love my fellow staff people here without being sexually involved with them. And is that what we were getting at? Is that what we were discussing? In other words, the two are intertwined, but not necessarily the same.
Yeah.
Isn't that where unification comes in? You know, that bonding of being one.
For centuries, people have taken, you know, the one flesh idea and done all kinds of things with it. You know, interpreted it 100 different ways. The twain shall become one flesh, and that means you make children. Which, you know, that's one thing out there, it's a product of both of you, or there's some kind of spiritual unity or some kind of physiological unity that goes on in the sex act. What I think the one flesh means is bonding. That's what I think it means. I don't know where that leaves you.
Yeah, it was really interesting. I like what he said. There was one of my dearest friends was in a nursing home. She's 27 years old and had muscular dystrophy, I believe, and a very sexual person in terms of the kids, the high school kids would take her out for a movie and she'd rave about Robert Redford or Paul Newman for hours, yet very loving too in spirit, although any of her relationships, most of them were even non-physical, but her spirit was so loving that if I ever wanted to learn anything about love or appreciating the opposite sex, as sexual and as a person, I can learn very much from her, and I appreciate that from, and I think a lot of that is her, you know, her close relationship with Christ too, and that encourages me, the wholeness of a person, but on the same hand, keeping that very, very excited, very positive about how God created man and woman to be one. It puzzles me because I read that verse in Genesis about how God did not intend for man to be alone, and yet at the same time, Nell, St. Paul, and Jesus, and very many other people who were single, and try to you know, keep that very positive image of being independent and single, adventurous, and also have my parents tell me, well, that's very selfish. And try to...
You're helping me. I'm coming out of the hole I was in, I think. Maybe where we've been going wrong is we think of love like a thermometer, you know, it just keeps going up, up, up. And then you get this little another piece and you go up a little higher. Maybe that's a wrong way to think about love. I'm trying now very rapidly to square that with the Corinthians we were working with the other day, and I can't. But could it be that there are all kinds and varieties of love, and that you got this huge panoply of love from which we sample, and married people who are able to bond sample this little bit up here. There's all this other kind that they might be sampling from as well. Nobody gets the whole business. Huh? Nobody contains that much love. So rather than thinking of love as something that is continuous, you know, and you just add on to it, and then you try to get all the pieces like a jigsaw puzzle, think of love rather as a bunch of grapes.